All right, I will call this remote hearing of the Judiciary, Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 3rd, 2022. The meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which allows us to hold these hearings remotely. I've been notified that a quorum is present and we'll go ahead with the roll. Anna, please go ahead.
Rebecca Finn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Frazier?
Present.
Representative Herr?
Present.
Representative Hollins?
Present.
Representative Johnson?
Present.
Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Long?
Present.
Representative Mortensen?
Present.
Representative Novotny? Representative Farr?
Present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Vang?
Present.
Representative Zhang?
All right, and with that, we'll move on to approval of the minutes. Members, do I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 1st?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Grossel.
Present.
All right, must have missed you. Sorry about that. The record will show that Representative Grossel is here and was on time. So Representative Grossel, would you like to move the minutes of February 1st?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Grossel moves the minutes of February 1st. Any discussion to the minutes? All right, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, we have a couple presentations today. I thank members for being willing to have, we had a hearing during the interim, and this is sort of part two of sort of getting an update from some of the other agencies that we have jurisdiction over. And today we'll be hearing from the judicial branch, from the courts, and also from the Department of Human Rights. So first up, we have the courts, and Mr. Shorba, the state court administrator, is here. If you want to introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning, Chair Becker Finn and members. My name is Jeff Shorba, and I have the privilege of serving as the state court administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. And I greatly appreciate the opportunity to talk to all of you today. And I want to thank you for inviting us to share this update with the committee. As I'm sure you'll remember, I testified before this committee near the start of last year's session. And during that presentation, I gave you an overview of our state court system and the work that occurs across our 87 district courts and two appellate courts. And I also talked to you about the challenges our courts have faced keeping the doors to justice open in Minnesota during this global health crisis. So my goal today is to give you an update on how our court system has navigated year two of the pandemic and to discuss with you the challenges and opportunities we face as we prepare to enter a third year. So last year, when I visited this committee, I gave you a detailed look at how our courts were adapting to the challenges of COVID-19 and the pandemic. As you know, those challenges haven't gone away, and our courts continue to be taking a variety of steps to keep judges, staff, attorneys, justice partners, and the public safe in our courthouses. The core of our pandemic response strategy has been our ongoing use of remote or online court hearings. So as you can see here on the screen, throughout 2021 and now into 2022, the vast majority of court hearings continue to be conducted online. Those are the hearings in the gray area on the chart. Over the past 3 months, 85% of all district court hearings have been held online. Our transition to remote hearings during the pandemic, I think I can say, has been an almost unqualified success. And as we'll discuss in a minute, we have undertaken extensive planning in the past year to determine how we can continue to use these new technologies even after the pandemic eventually subsides. So while most hearings remain online, district courts are still holding around 3,000 in-person hearings each week. Our top priority for in-person hearings is addressing the backlog of felony and gross misdemeanor criminal cases that have resulted from the pandemic. That includes holding trials, settlement conferences, grand jury proceedings, and various types of evidentiary hearings in the courthouse. And we'll talk more in depth about that backlog of criminal cases in just a moment. We also have a high number of other priority matters being held in the courthouse, including civil jury trials, juvenile delinquency and juvenile protection matters, and evidentiary hearings and other case types. Of course, practices may vary from courthouse to courthouse, depending on local conditions and the discretion of local judges. So the Chief Justice has granted by order each judicial district the authority to temporarily limit in-person proceedings based on criteria such as local infection rates, the availability of judges, staff, jurors, and justice partners, along with other factors that we've seen throughout the pandemic. So in recent weeks, you may have heard, we've seen several districts take steps to temporarily shift more proceedings to online hearings, given the impact the recent Omicron wave has had on their local communities. We're hopeful once this wave eventually subsides, things will move back to our more typical pandemic operations. I do want to note that we still have our pandemic preparedness plan in place, which details the health and safety precautions our courthouses need to have to safely conduct in-person court hearings. And that includes the required use of face coverings, distancing measures in the courtroom and throughout the courthouse, and enhanced cleaning and sanitation protocols. So I talked about that with you last year, and that is still in place. Before I get into the work being done to address the criminal backlog, I'm going to give you a short update on the status of eviction cases. Last year, when I appeared before you, I discussed the efforts being made to plan for the end of the eviction moratorium. All of this great work was done in collaboration with local justice partners and community-based organizations across the state. We recognized that a challenge of this magnitude and importance could not be solved by the courts alone. It required enhanced collaboration between the bench, the bar, landlords and tenants, and community-based advocacy organizations. For all the great work done in this area, I want to recognize that the end of the eviction moratorium has been a difficult and trying time for many people in our state. And we are going to feel the lasting effects of the moratorium and the economic disruption of the pandemic for quite a while to come. So I'm careful not to talk about this challenge like it's in the past tense. However, if we look just at the administrative side of the challenge, that is ensuring our courts have the capacity and resources to provide prompt access to justice for renters and landlords, I believe all of our planning and partnership on this issue has been a great success. As you can see on the screen, eviction filings have rebounded closer to their pre-pandemic levels. However, thanks to the eviction off-ramp passed by the legislature last year and the Rent Help Minnesota program led by Minnesota Housing, the rise in case filings has been relatively gradual. Our courts, by and large, are managing this increased caseload. And as of mid-January, when I pulled the data, nearly 90% of pending cases had either been heard by the court or had a first hearing scheduled. So our extensive planning meant that we had the infrastructure in place to manage the increased caseload without any substantial impact on other court operations. And to give you an update on where things stand on the eviction off-ramp, until June 2022, an eviction can be filed except for those based on non-payment of rent for tenants who have pending applications for rental assistance. So as you know, we learned last week that the Rent Help Minnesota program is no longer accepting new applications. So while this may lead to increased filings going forward, I believe our collaboration with Rent Help Minnesota and Minnesota Housing will continue as the program continues to assist all those who applied before the deadline. And I think if you're looking for some silver lining in all of this, and who isn't these days, I think you will see the enhanced partnerships, increased access to resources, and really creative calendaring practices we have integrated into our housing courts and housing calendars will continue into the future, even after the pandemic subsides. This is sort of a theme. Our courts have learned so much throughout the pandemic about how to implement these practices into our operations, and in this case, how much they can benefit both landlords and tenants. So, as I just noted, our top priority right now is addressing the backlog of felony and gross misdemeanor cases in our district courts. In the first couple of months of the pandemic, when our state was under the governor's stay-at-home order and we had limited access to our courthouses, we saw a significant backlog of major criminal cases build up in our district courts. In the year and a half since then, our district courts have done a remarkable job of using in-person and remote hearings to keep pace with the incoming caseloads. However, given our public health precautions, we haven't been able to bring down that initial buildup of felony and gross misdemeanor cases from the early weeks of the pandemic. So here on the screen, you can see the size of the problem. By the end of 2021, there were 12,000 more active pending felony and gross misdemeanor cases in Minnesota district courts than before the start of the pandemic, a 34% increase in the state's pending major criminal caseload. I don't have to tell this audience that a backlog like that in major criminal matters has serious implications for the constitutional rights of Minnesotans, from being able to meet demands for speedy trials to having defendants in custody awaiting trial. But we also have to keep in mind that this backlog really has broader implications for our justice system. If we aren't able to get our arms around this backlog quickly, it really could have a long-term impact on our ability to deliver timely access to justice across our courts. That is why this past November, we put into action a statewide strategy to tackle the backlog. Each of our 10 judicial districts, working with local criminal justice partners, developed a localized plan for addressing the backlog. The Judicial Council recognized that our judges and staff were already giving their maximum effort to maintaining access to justice during this unprecedented crisis, and that our justice partners were already stretched to their limits. And that's why the council was committed to securing additional resources to help us tackle this statewide challenge. We were extremely grateful to secure roughly $10 million in federal pandemic relief money to put our backlog reduction plans into place. That money is going towards using senior judges and referees, hiring temporary staff, holding special case processing events, and other actions to hear additional criminal cases in order to bring down the backlog. These additional resources have allowed us to hear additional criminal cases without impacting our ability to hear cases in other case types. Our goal is to reduce the pending caseload of major criminal cases by 20% every 4 months. And if we are able to keep up with this aggressive schedule, we will eliminate the entirety of the pandemic backlog by June 2023. The money we received to implement our backlog reduction strategy isn't the only way federal pandemic relief funding has helped our courts during these difficult times. As you can see on the screen, we received CARES Act funding on three occasions, which helped pay for personal protective equipment for judges, staff, and court users, remote hearing and teleworking technology, and our first attempt at tackling our pandemic backlog, which unfortunately was cut short by our first winter pandemic surge in late 2020. We asked for an extension to use that money, but unfortunately the extension was not granted and we needed to return a large share of that initial funding. But thankfully, the passage of the American Rescue Plan gave us another chance to secure money to help address our backlog. Before I leave this section about our continued pandemic response, I'm going to share what I believe is some really positive news about the future of remote hearings in our district courts. Throughout the pandemic, we have used surveys, focus groups, and other methods to gather feedback from judges, staff, attorneys, justice partners, and litigants about the use of remote hearings. And the feedback we have received has been overwhelmingly positive. Users appreciate the ease and convenience of remote hearings, as well as the cost savings of not having to take time off of work, find childcare, and travel to and park at a courthouse just to participate in a short court hearing. Given the success we've had with remote hearings during the pandemic and the positive feedback we receive from users, the Judicial Council has committed to keeping remote hearings part of our long-term court operations, even after the worst impacts of the pandemic subside. So this past September, the Judicial Council adopted a framework for the long-term use of remote hearings in our district courts. The framework sets out a phased approach for how we will continue using remote hearings and will take effect once pandemic operations have improved and we're able to transition to more normal court operations. We've also established a work group of judges and court administrators from across the state to oversee implementation of the framework and support our district courts as we become more accustomed to operating in this new environment. So while I'm not going to walk you through all the details of the framework during my short time with you today, I thought it was important to share this important and actually historic decision with all of you. For as difficult as the pandemic has been, the success of remote hearings has been really a bright spot in terms of access to justice. I see there's a question, Madam Chair.
I think we're gonna save questions till the end because I wanna make sure we stay on schedule to get your presentation done. But noted, Representative Scott will definitely have time for questions when he's done with the presentation.
Thank you. Next, I'm going to give you an update on one of our biggest pandemic era accomplishments of our court system, the long anticipated launch of online access to district court case documents. We officially launched the first phase of Minnesota court records online on March 17th. In its first phase, MCRO, as it's called, allowed users for the first time to access most public district court case documents online, but only searching with a case number at that point. But it was clear from the start that we had much pent-up demand for this level of record access. The day we launched MCRO, more than 3,700 users downloaded more than 10,000 case documents using the application. We spent the rest of 2021 developing the second phase of the application. We launched phase two on December 7th, which added several important enhancements, including more robust search functionality, a redesigned register of actions, and I'm proud to report that more than 3 million documents have been downloaded through MCRO since its initial launch. We're currently developing the third and final phase of MCRO, which we aim to release later this calendar year. It's going to bring additional search functionality, and it will mark the end of the development of MCRO, at which point we will consider the application complete. With the completion of MCRO, we will begin applying a fee to access court documents. Users will be able to view the first page of documents as a preview and then have the option of paying an access fee to view subsequent pages or download the document. I do want to make note that at present, approximately two-thirds of all court documents are one page long, so those would continue to be free. The access fee will be the same amount as purchasing a document at a courthouse. The fee is currently $8, which is set by state statute, so we are complying with the state statute. And as with all paper copies, the revenue from those fees will go to the state general fund. I'm proud to say that this effort has been developed all during the COVID-19 pandemic, and I think the launch has been a really huge success. MCRO is just one example of the technological achievements underway in our courts. Many things tied into online access, an online version of the statewide public defender application, which allows defendants to complete and submit it from a computer, smartphone, or tablet. We're currently pilot testing a new digital exhibit management system, which will provide an easier and more secure way for attorneys and litigants to share digital exhibits with the court. We're also in the early stages of developing a new online hearing check-in process, which will allow case participants to take care of the administrative work they need to do before a hearing, up to five days in advance. And courts have also done a great job accommodating litigants who do not have access to computers and the internet to enable them to participate in remote hearings. So many courthouses have set up special rooms, which are private spaces individuals can use that are equipped with all that technology. That's just a quick snapshot of some of the new and interesting innovations happening in our court system. I'd be more than happy to go into greater detail, but I want to end by talking about a preview sort of the budget request we'll be sharing with you later this session. I'm going to talk about one of the biggest challenges facing our organization, and that issue is employee recruitment and retention. And I know it's an issue facing virtually every public and private employer these days. I'm going to share a couple simple graphs to give you some ideas of what we're facing in the state court system. Here on the screen, you can see the share of employees who left employment with the judicial branch in each of the past 4 years. That share of employees has increased by 42% since 2018. And as you can see on this chart, not only are we posting more job openings, we're receiving fewer and fewer applications for each open position. Back in 2019, we had an average of 48 applicants. Last year, we were down to 19 applicants for each open position. What does that mean? It means we're still able to fill jobs for the most part, but may have fewer people to interview, fewer people to select from, and sometimes have to repost or find other creative ways to fill these roles. Without question, these workforce challenges are extremely complicated issues with many different drivers. We routinely survey departing employees to figure out how we can do better at attracting and retaining employees in the future. But one issue we can't address on our own is our compensation system, which in many ways has fallen behind our public sector peers in recent years. This is just one illustrative example of what this looks like for our employees. On this chart, you can see the hypothetical salary progression of two employees hired at the same time at the same rate of pay in both the judicial and executive branches. While both employees earned 2.5% merit increases in their first 3 years, the executive branch also offered across-the-board salary increases on top of the merit increases. In just 3 years, the judicial branch employee is earning 7% less than the executive branch counterpart who was hired at the same wage. And this is just one example of how the branch compensation structure has fallen behind other public sector organizations. When I come to testify about our budget request, I'll provide you additional examples. But my point is, if left unaddressed, these recruitment and retention issues are going to have a very real impact on our ability to carry out our constitutional mission. Which brings me to my final slide, and that is to provide you an overview of the judicial branch's supplemental budget request for fiscal year 23. I will, of course, provide much more detail when we come before the committee, but we'll be asking for an additional $21.5 million. It's about a 2.7% increase over our biennial base budget to address three major areas. First and foremost, compensation for judges and staff to address the concerns I've put forward. Second, to provide adequate funding in the areas of mandated services, expenses the branch must pay for, particularly in the areas of psychological exams and interpreter services. And third, to adequately fund our efforts to protect branch data and information through enhanced cybersecurity. So I look forward to that conversation with the committee. But on behalf of the judges and staff of the branch, I thank you for the opportunity to be here today and to share some of the things we've been going through over the last year. And I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Shorba. And I think actually I'll start off with a question since we just landed on that question about salaries for judicial department staff. And remind me, what was the request from the judicial branch last biennium? I know we landed on 2.5%, but I can't remember what the request was.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. So if you'll remember way back long ago when we had to put in our budget request for the biennium, we were facing what we thought was an extreme deficit in the budget. So the Judicial Council decided to be conservative and help the governor and the legislature with that deficit. So we only asked for 2.5% in the first year of the biennium. We did not ask for any increase in the second year. And thankfully, you provided that 2.5, but right now we have no funding for the second year of the biennium. So that's where this request is focused. Thank you for that question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Sherba. And I will give you the same message I give our other justice partners when they come before this committee, and that is I need you to ask for what you need to run the courts well. And, you know, if we never ask for what we need, we'll never get to that point. So I would just really encourage, you know, in these conversations that we're just really clear about what that dollar amount gets us and, you know, how that ends up working out when you put up a slide like that, doing the comparison. You know, we've had similar conversations with the public defenders and civil legal services and their staff being really underpaid compared even to other public sector work as well. So I, you know, just want to send that message loud and clear when you come back with the budget request, that we're clear about what that amount gets us and whether that actually is moving the needle forward. So with that, we'll move on to member questions. We have quite a few. First, I will go to Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sherba. That was really informative and a lot of information to take in at one time, but I appreciate all the work that the judicial branch has been doing, especially during COVID and trying to adjust accordingly. I do have one question specifically about the new system for documents access, and I'm really interested if this decision was pre-pandemic or post-pandemic. I know that it's been implemented post-pandemic, but I'm wondering if you know, the origin of this idea of charging the amount happened during the pandemic or beforehand, and then and what that fee is for, because in my experience, it was always, the idea was that it was for printing costs, which absolutely makes sense, and having somebody there to print it and things like that, you know, is cost prohibitive. But now if it's just for downloading, I'm a little confused about what the $8 fee is for. Can you give me more information on that?
Mr. Sherba.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Hollins, this has been a process that has been in the works for a number of years. We knew that our current system was not meeting the needs of our customers. So we initially began to look at a vendor to try to put this together, and that was not successful. A vendor couldn't perform the needs that we had, so we decided to develop it in-house, and that's where we came up with this three-phase process. The Judicial Council had a steering committee to oversee this process, and our recommendation to the council was, based on the wording of the statute, we needed to provide a fee for access to these documents. You as the legislature can decide we're wrong on that and decide online stuff doesn't need a fee and paper stuff does. I would just caution you, we've had some questions from legislators, well, why don't we charge a $2 fee for online and an $8 fee for in the courthouse? We'd like to be consistent one way or another. Either we're going to charge for things or we're not going to charge for things. Anything that changes it significantly versus just not charging for online is going to create additional development costs for the process that we put in place. So we were trying to abide by the wording of the statute that we needed to charge a fee for access to documents, whether that was paper or online. But that's certainly up for you. And I know some representatives and senators are thinking about bills in this area to try to change that. Hope that answers your question.
Yep. And I think for the public and others' knowledge, it's the statute that you're referencing is 357.021. And it's section, it's subdivision 2, which reads certified copy of any instrument from a civil or criminal proceeding, $14, and $8 for an uncertified copy. So I suppose it would be the courts that would determine what the legislative intent would be on whether that applies to online documents or not. You know, I think that's sort of a an open question. Any follow-up, Representative Hollins?
Not at this time. I need to process this a little bit, but I appreciate the thorough answer. Thank you, Mr. Shorba.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to make one comment on the videography of hearings and that sort of thing. And while I certainly understand the convenience of it, one of the things that I think can act as a deterrent for people, particularly first-time offenders or whatever, is just the sobering notion of walking into the courtroom and the judge is up on a rostrum and they're there to answer for their behavior. And so that's just something that in the back of my mind is like, I would think that that would be a deterrent for future crime. But I did want to talk a little bit about what's going on in the courts right now and in the criminal justice system with as it relates to crime. And so my question to Mr. Shorba is, are you seeing because of the backlog of in the courts that we're letting people out on bail and they're on the streets and then they're repeating? Are you seeing that that is something that the courts have moved to?
I have not.
Mr. Shorba, I'm not sure if you're the person who's able to answer that question, but give it a shot.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I was just going to say the same thing. That may be something that sentencing guidelines or somebody else who collects that data in a more thorough manner than myself would be able to answer. But so I don't want to speculate if that's okay.
Yep, Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I cite a couple of cases. I get the local Anoka County paper, and one of the there was a person that was charged with third degree murder for knowingly selling fentanyl-laced narcotics to a person that resulted in that person's death. And the judge let them off with probation because they were remorseful. And I look at another case where we had a carjacking and a sexual assault of somebody, and we find out later that that person was on supervised release with zero bail. So these sorts of cases give me a lot of concern as crime is getting more and more out of hand. And I know maybe you're saying that this isn't your that this should be directed to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and maybe we should, I don't know, maybe the chair would entertain the idea of having them come in. But, you know, our staff did a deep dive into the data provided by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and they found that in 40% of the cases across the state, judges were departing downwardly in the cases where people were supposed to go to prison according to the guidelines, but they were getting probation instead. And so I'm wondering if you might have and this was 2019 data. So this wasn't even, this is pre-pandemic data. These were charges that were probably happening in 17 and 18. And it didn't matter if it was who appointed the judge, it was across the state. And I'm wondering if Mr. Shorba might have an idea of, is there a culture within the courts to downwardly depart? What might be happening if you have any sort of idea on that?
Mr. Shorba, and I'll just, I think some of this may be the kind of thing that I would guess is discussed in public safety. I know sometimes the line between judiciary and public safety gets a little squishy on some things, but Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I think that may be a good question if we want to have some discussion about that, to have a conversation with judges about how those decisions are made. In many cases where you see downward departures, there's been some agreement between prosecutors and public defenders that are brought to the judge, and the judge then agrees with that decision and may depart from whatever the guideline is on that. It's really difficult to talk about individual cases because they're all so fact specific, but maybe from a judge's perspective, they could give you a little bit of an idea of the thought process that goes behind it. That's just my idea of some of the considerations that a judge may have.
Final follow-up, Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that. And Mr. Shorba, if you, you know, I'm glad to sit down with anybody to talk about this. The data that we have from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission is that that 2019 number is the highest it's been in a very, very, very long time. And that's concerning. And if there's something within the culture of the judiciary, if it's the prosecutors, there's not as much data on them because they don't have to explain themselves as to why they do or don't charge someone or lower the, I'm sorry, my dog's scratching itself, why they do or do not have to, or do or do not, you know, charge somebody or depart from what the guidelines are. So I would love to have a conversation going forward on this. I think it's, the general public is not happy about these criminals being turned back out on the street and reoffending. It's a problem. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Next, go to Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do think, you know, the questions that Representative Scott raised, I think we'll be having those discussions in the Public Safety Committee. And I'm looking forward to having those discussions, looking forward to having individuals and representatives that actually work in those particular areas and do the work, discuss how they make their decisions. I think there's a lot of data out there that we need to collect. It's going to be incumbent on all of our criminal justice partners to share the data that they have. And that goes from law enforcement in terms of the arrests they make, the evidence that they collect or the evidence that they can't collect. That leads into how prosecutors can prosecute those cases. And that information also is a determinant on how our judges make their decisions. So a lot of evidence out, a lot of information out there that needs to be collected and analyzed. And I just want to impair upon our members, we need to look at all of that information and look at all of the voices and stakeholders within our criminal justice system and our criminal justice partners and not paint any narratives that that are inaccurate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Any response, Mr. Shorba?
No, we're happy to have conversations either with public safety or with individual representatives like Representative Scott to delve into this a little bit more. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say to Representative Hollins and other members on the committee, and of course, Mr. Shorba, that I dropped a bill on Tuesday to address that $8 filing fee for the online records access, and I would welcome everyone to co-author. I just checked and the bill number isn't up there yet, but it hopefully will be posted later today and I'll send it around. But I think this is an issue I've heard from my constituents about as well. I get charging for the in-person fee when staff time is used and copying fees are used, but the online access should be free, especially when the money is going to the general fund, not even going to the court. So I urge all of you to take a look at my bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. And the first I'm hearing of it, I'm also working on a bill. So hopefully this is an area where we can find some common ground. And I think there's certainly consensus among the public that, you know, we should be making sure that publicly classified documents are able to be accessed by the public. So thank you for that comment. Next, we'll go to Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick question regarding the evictions. Since the closing of Rent Help Minnesota, Mr. Shorba, how much more has been about non-payment of rent in terms of eviction filings?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Vang, it's a little too early to tell yet what the data is going to show, since it was just last week that that change was announced. So I'm probably able, when we come back to talk about the budget request, to have more recent data, but I will certainly track down that question and maybe look at our filings and see what the reasons were. It's a good question.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Shorba. And if you can, you know, if you're able to find that information before we have you back on the budget request, we can certainly, if you can send that to the committee administrator, we can share that with members as well. Sure. Any follow-up, Representative Vang? Her hand went down, so I think she's good. Next, we'll go to Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, members, I just have a couple questions for Mr. Shorba. The first deals with remote hearings. I'm glad they're looking at some of the remote hearings. I think some like in custodies and civil commitments, and some of those are important that they could be done remotely because of travel costs. And I myself on a civil commitment hearing drove 4 hours to go pick somebody up, 4 hours back to have a 15-minute court time. And then they were driven 4 hours up by another deputy and 4 hours back. So things like that could actually save not only the state but the county a lot of funding and funds and dollars by being able to do some of these in the in custody civil commitments. I'm just wondering what other types of hearings are you looking at to do virtual as we're doing now?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I can certainly provide, I didn't have time in this presentation, but I can certainly provide to the committee the Judicial Council's recommendation. It has a chart that lists each case type and actually type of hearings that we think should presumptively be remote or presumptively be in person. As I mentioned, most of the ones where you're presenting evidence or criminal matters would be in person, but maybe in some of the civil areas or the family areas, they could be, especially for short hearings like you're talking about, could be presumptively remote. So I can provide that detailed information, and then maybe when I come back or you want to talk about it in more detail, I would be happy to discuss that with you. But thank you for that questions. And your example is a very important one. The Sheriff's Association is very interested in keeping some of these things remote for the exact reasons you gave.
Yeah, and I think I used to clerk in Hennepin County family court, civil court, and I know some of our calendars, you know, we'd have people waiting around for hours for a hearing that would take 5 minutes as a kind of check-in hearing, you know, on a civil matter. It doesn't really make sense for people to take a whole day off of work, you know, if there's a way that we can do it well remotely. So I'm glad to hear that that's being looked into, Mr. Shorba. Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Yeah. I appreciate the information because I think with this virtual, you can actually help get rid of the backlog. But the other thing I would like to know, the recent John Hopkins research study found out that these lockdowns and shutdowns and locking everything up actually did basically nothing on the pandemic. So I'm wondering how soon we're going to get those courts open so we can get rid of this backlog, because the sooner we get them open, the sooner we can get rid of this backlog.
Representative Johnson, this is not the Health Committee. And, you know, if we're going to reference the results of any studies, I would just ask that you share that with the committee. You know, we're not going to get into that as far as dueling research and what people can Google online relative to the pandemic. Mr. Shorba, to what the courts are doing.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, every week we meet to look at basically three factors that are affecting the operations of our courts. One is the overall infection rate going on in the state of Minnesota. The second is our jury appearance rate. So we are tracking when our jurors tell us either because they're sick or they have a relative that's sick or they're quarantining, they cannot come in for jury duty. And those numbers have been going up with Omicron. And then the last thing is infection rates among our judges and our staff, which have also been going up during Omicron. So those are the three things we look at every week. We have various parameters where we'll decide to take particular action. Right now, we're in not our most restrictive phase that we were in the fall of 2020, but one where we've given, as I mentioned, some leeway to our chief judges in each of our districts to take more restrictive actions if they feel necessary. So those are the things we look at. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shorba. Quick follow-up, Representative Johnson, and then we've got Grossel and Moeller, and then we will move on to Representative Egbadje's bill. Representative Johnson.
No follow-up. Just want to thank Mr. Shorba for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Shorba, I guess maybe I missed it, but these criminal case backlogs. Where are these people sitting? Are they waiting court in custody, or are they waiting court in the community?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, if they have speedy trial demands, we've moved their cases up to the top of the list because they're probably in custody, not able to get out of custody. So we are prioritizing those cases. In other situations, it depends on, you know, the individual facts of the case. Some are released, some are still in custody. So it varies. That's, I guess, my scientific answer here. There's no one answer to that particular question, but it is a reason why we're very concerned about this backlog for these constitutional issues.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you. That's it.
All right. Vice Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Shorba, thank you so much for your testimony today. I had a question about slide number 5. I don't know if you can get that back up again. It was related to the backlog. And I guess my question relates to how are you defining the backlog? So what I guess I'm wondering here is, are you including, I see here that there's a 34% increase in pending felony and gross misdemeanor cases since March of 2020. And so how are you defining backlog? Is that all cases, including new ones that have come in since March of 2020, or is that just prior cases?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, these are prior cases. So as I mentioned, in the court system, we have what is called the clearance rate, which is how many new cases are coming in and how many old cases are going out. So in a highly functioning court system, you want to have 100% clearance rate so that your new cases have room to come in as your old cases go out. This 34% increase is cases that have been around since March of 2020. So we're trying to take care of the new cases that come in, but the resources we just got under the federal pandemic relief is to bring additional resources to try to deal with the cases that have been sitting around. And so really this is cases have been around prior to the pandemic and have been building up in those few months beginning in the pandemic. So it's not the new ones coming in, it's the ones that have been remaining, if that helps.
Yeah, that does answer.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Mr. Shorba, that does answer my question. I guess I'm curious to know then, with all the new cases coming in, if you have any information on that in addition to the backlog cases.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, sure, we do. I didn't put it in this presentation. We could certainly give you case filing information and various case types, criminal, civil, family. We're pretty much taking care of our civil family cases. We don't really have a backlog in civil or family. The backlog is really a major criminal, but I can certainly get case filing information to the committee.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Shorba. I think that would be helpful. I think for this committee, all of the both civil and criminal would be useful to know, but I guess I'm especially interested in the criminal new case filings at this point. Thank you.
Representative Robbins, real quick, and then we got to move on to the next item.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. Mr. Shorba, I was also reviewing the federal slide about the funding, slide number 7. You don't need to answer it or go to it, but if you could just give me a better breakdown of that. I thought it was pretty top line, and I'd like to know what you have left, what you're targeting it to, and if you could just make that available to the whole committee, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Yep. Mr. Shorba, if you could send that to Bryn, our committee administrator, we'll make sure that all members get that. With that, thank you, Mr. Shorba, for being here and being able to answer questions. I think this is really good to get members thinking about this and to really get an update from how the courts are doing and, good preview for when you come forward with your budget request. So with that, members, we will move on. We're going to do the bill, Representative Agbaje's bill, House File 1315. I will move that House File, well, actually, Representative Hollins, would you like to move House File 1315 to be referred to the General Register?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, so moved.
Great. Representative Hollins moves House File 1315 be referred to the General Register. Representative Agbaje, if you can go ahead and present your bill, and then I know we have a couple testifiers here today. So, Representative Agbaje.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and good morning to members of the committee. So I'm here this morning to present House File 1315. This bill is known as the Crown Act, which stands for Creating a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair. The purpose of this bill is to clarify the definition of race in the Minnesota Human Rights Act to include race-based traits like hair texture and styles, including braids, twists, and locks. Across the country and in the state of Minnesota, we have had incidents of people experiencing discrimination because of how their hair grows naturally from their head. And when enacted, this bill will make it clear that such discrimination will no longer be tolerated in the state. I myself have felt the pressure to straighten my hair because of a fear of losing a job or not being able to be taken as seriously. And I straightened my hair for most of my life, only recently allowing myself to be myself. And I'm glad to carry this bill to ensure that people have the freedom to show up as they are in school and at work and focus on the task at hand rather than worrying about whether their hair will cause a loss of an education or earning an income. So today I have some testifiers with me who will share their stories about why this bill is important to them and how their lives have been affected without having this legislation in place. Thank you.
All right, then. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. First on the list, I have Vachel Hudson. If you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Absolutely. Thank you all for your time. Thank you, Representative Bajay and Chair Becker-Finn, for hearing this bill and bringing it forward to the committee. My name is Vachel Hudson, and I am a transplant from Louisville, Kentucky. I reside in Elliott Park neighborhood, and I also own property and am a landlord in North Minneapolis. I serve as the Housing and Wealth Development Manager at the Urban League Twin Cities, and have the pleasure of serving as the president of the Urban League Twin Cities Young Professionals, which is an auxiliary chapter of the National Urban League Young Professionals. And I speak on behalf of my community, peers, chapter members, networks, when I say that we support and need the Crown Act passed. In a climate like Minnesota, when it can get below 0 degrees, my hair is not only an added layer to help me stay warm as I adjust and live in a place totally opposite of where I'm born and where my roots are, but it's also one of the only natural ties that some of folk like myself and our youth have to our culture and our heritage. Currently, we're only being taught that slavery, Black history is slavery in our schools. So many of our youth see celebrities such as Lil Durk, Lil Baby, Lil Domingos, Kodak Blacks, many other artists and entertainers with dreads and natural hairstyles that may rap about money, guns, drugs, and abuse more than the youth see Black engineers, teachers, lawyers, doctors, bankers, and other high-paying professionals with the same hairstyles as themselves, who they could see themselves in and aspire to become. Even Jay-Z, one of the most widely known and respected Black moguls, has grown dreads, and it's in a style that probably wouldn't slide in a corporate setting, depending on their organization's policies. Therefore, some of the most powerful and respected partners and corporations have no issue with sitting with him at his table or him at theirs. Our youth and community will have more upside and impact to society when we're exposed to positive role models who look like us, and we will perform better when we can be our authentic selves rather than trying to live the life that these rappers and entertainers are speaking over the airwaves, which then causes us to possibly spiral into a path of destruction, as we mentioned earlier, carjackings, robberies. As the epic center of a national global racial awakening, Minnesota has and continues to be on the microscope of what and how our society wants to move forward. We can't talk about diversity or racial equity and justice in the workplace without talking about discriminatory policies, such as a dress code and an appearance code, which also prevents Black and brown people from accessing economic opportunities, in addition to its impact on our mental health. We're the only ethnic group who has to have a law to protect something that is already a part of our DNA. I urge you all, please pass the Crown Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Vachel, for your testimony. Next, we have Chiquana McIntyre. Chiquana, if you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Fan. My name is Chiquana McIntyre. I am the president and founder of Family Rise Together and Proven Solutions. My studies is in child protection services, so I was a child protection social worker here in South St. Louis County for about 10 years. My story is a bit different, and it's a little, it's strange for me to be in this moment at this time because I found myself this morning actually wrapping my hair to look presentable and be professional for this setting. And it was not until he started talking and sharing his story that I actually took my scarf off. And I'm saying to myself, this is why I'm here. This is why I must speak up. So that wasn't intended, but my testimony is, I support this bill because of the very children that I serve, the very community that I serve. When we are looking and working with families where their children are at risk of placement or already in placement, they are at more risk of their hair and their skin being neglected. They are also at risk of being discriminated against in schools while in placement and being cared for by social services. The lack of education, the lack of training, and though foster parents step up to do their very best, the ignorance of our hair and our skin affects the self-esteem of the children whom we serve. And that for me is an issue. I support this bill because this bill will also open up the door for my own children not to question their value, their self-worth, or their presence in any space because they look and they feel different. I support this bill because I myself have struggled with my own identity crisis with dealing with my own hair as a professional Black woman in Duluth, Minnesota. I too have straightened my hair, cut my hair, kept my hair braided to look and be presentable so that I can be taken seriously. I ask Chair Becker-Fan, and I apologize if I'm not addressing everyone properly, but I support this bill and I ask that you support this bill for the simple fact that our well-being and our self-esteem is attached to our crown, which is our hair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you did a great job testifying. No problems there. Next, we'll go to Lenora Warfield. Lenora, if you can unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Well, hello, my name is Lenora Warfield. I am a female entrepreneur and I'm here supporting the Crown Act bill to be passed. And for me, I'm testifying for this because I do, as a professional woman, I own my own home. I have a hair salon located in Fridley, Minnesota, which is located inside of a senior living building. And the reason why I'm putting that out there is because I feel that there can be some discrimination there. So for me, growing up, I love the fact that my hair was very versatile. I would always style my hair and wear my hair natural curls, braids. I would even straighten it or even wear extensions. And I took great pride in my hair. So once I joined the working field, I worked primarily in healthcare as a certified nursing assistant, just because I love to care for others. But while I was working there, I really felt that there was much discrimination against my hair, as the people there didn't mind that my hair was in the styles that I had it, because it did not define my abilities to care for them as long as they needed my help. And so now that I'm a business owner, serving clients in a setting that's mainly Caucasian, and some of the people may have failing health, I see that the discrimination is more prevalent. I see it when I get the stares or the obscene questions on how do I care for my own hair, or how do I care for, or how I would even care for their hair. I see it when the residents would rather go to a different salon, knowing that there's a salon located inside of their place of residence. And the reason why I'm dedicated to raising this issue is that the discrimination is solely based on my hair. I feel that my licensing and my professionalism should speak for itself and let the people know that I'm capable enough to do their hair as well. So like you and everyone out there, I'm a successful person. I'm a member of Shiloh Missionary Baptist Church. I'm also a member of the Minneapolis Urban League Twin Cities young professional. I volunteer my services to help others to bridge the gap in the generational wealth in our community. And I'm a positive contributor to this community. So yet the first thing I am judged on is my hair, which is simply a representation of who I am, my heritage and my roots. I find that very disrespectful. And I would like, you know, for you guys to pass this bill just because I want also for my children to be able to be comfortable in their skin and not to be intimidated or not hired or not advanced or treated poorly or discriminated against by the racial behavior simply based on their hair. And I respectfully ask that you support the bill to be passed for the Crown Act so we can join these other states that are making a statement and so that we can be that much closer to a just and fair society. So thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, and then Representation Abaje. I appreciate it and hope you will pass the bill as well.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next I have, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name, Cesarina Natanga. If you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Sure, thank you. My name is Cesarine Tunga, and you weren't too far off. And I am a first generation African American woman. I've been a Minnesota resident my entire life, being raised in Apple Valley and currently living in Bloomington, Minnesota. I volunteer as the parliamentarian with the Urban League Twin Cities Young Professionals. And professionally, I have been working in customer service spaces my entire career. Most recently, I am serving as a community engagement specialist for a nonprofit here in the Twin Cities that serves individuals and families who are impacted by domestic violence, as well as children who have been experiencing different traumas as well. Throughout my career, I've been placed in situations where I've had to battle between showing up as my authentic self versus conforming to what predominantly white spaces have seen as professional or acceptable, whether it's straightening my hair or having to pay top dollar to be able to style my hair in a certain way when I should be able to just come out with a shampoo and conditioner like other people are able to just wash their hair in the morning and go. They don't have to spend as much money and do as much upkeep to battle the same types of discrimination that we do. And I just feel very passionate about this because I grew up having to sit through the painful processes of getting my hair chemically treated and relaxed and permed for years, damaging my scalp, risking my health just to fit into these systems that weren't built for me. So that's just been very unfair. And I feel as though children that I'm going to be raising, my nieces and nephews who are out here growing up in the same communities that I did, don't have to face the same things as me. Naturally, we've been able to raise them up to build up their confidence and feel comfortable going out in their afros, going out in their twists and their braids. But we have to work that much harder because they go into spaces and aren't accepted. And that's just not fair to them. They shouldn't have to go through that. And we shouldn't have had to go through that either. It wasn't until I got to college that I made the decision to chop off all of that relaxed hair and go natural and have been embracing that journey since then. But it still wasn't until I got into a Black-owned business that I work for that I felt completely comfortable in being able to show up with my hair, whether it's in twists, locks, fro, whatever, a ponytail that just happens to be a little more curly than someone else that doesn't look like me. It wasn't until I got into that space that I felt comfortable doing that. And I should have been comfortable with that no matter where I am. And that's what we're pushing for with this bill. And that's the support that we're looking to get as we're pushing this bill forward. And we just want to thank you for giving us this platform, the space to be able to speak. Representative Abaje, we really appreciate your support. And Chair Becker-Finn, I hope I'm presenting myself well here. And we just want to thank you again for this opportunity and hearing our testimonies and our voices. And we really hope that you do support this bill and push this forward because there has to be some changes.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and you all did an amazing job. This is really good testimony here this morning, so thank you very much. We have one last testifier on the list, Commissioner Lucero. If you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself, and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, committee. Good morning, Chair Beckerfin. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I am the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. It's great to be here with you all again. And I really want to thank you for hearing Representative Agbaje's, Agbaje's bill this first week of session. I think this signifies how important this issue is. And I do want to really be brief because I want to let the powerful stories of each one of these testifiers stand for themselves. So the Minnesota Department of Human Rights strongly supports the Crown Act. Hair discrimination is race discrimination. And each one of these testifiers told that story beautifully. So, you know, that is all I wanted to say. Just wanted to voice the support of the department around this and express gratitude to every single one of the testifiers that's championing this issue today. I know I'll talk further about our agency, and I'm happy to stand for any specific questions on this. But thank you for the time.
Thank you, Commissioner Lucero. We don't have any other testifiers. Members, any questions? Representative Herr.
Not specifically a question, but a comment just to thank Representative Agbaje for bringing this bill forward. I think I might have shared this the last time it was brought forward, and I think that we have perceptions of who we think this bill would pertain to. And I just want to share real quick again that I have actually really curly hair, and I straighten my hair every single day. And at time, I've been encouraged to, you know, when people have seen my hair natural, they'd say, oh, you should wear your hair natural. And I tried it a couple of times, and I'd come to work and people would say, oh, did you not have time to like fix your hair today? Or, oh, you look so messy today. Is everything okay? And it's like, no, it's just my natural hair. I have really curly hair. And so I think that it is really important for us to remember that this is, you know, like this impacts everyone who has this hair texture. And so I just really want to thank Representative Agbaje, because I don't think that oftentimes people associate this issue with an Asian person. We're always known as like having long, straight black hair, and that's just not true. And there's a big segment of us that have very naturally curly hair, and we straighten it every single day. And I put products in my hair every day, and I flat iron it or blow it out every single day. And it is really damaging. And it is just something that I wish I could just show up and go to work and not have to do that too. So I really appreciate the testifiers today. And also everyone who spoke to this, because this really is an issue. And it is a judgment on our leadership, our ability to do our jobs, and how we show up in those spaces. And so thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as you all can see, I am hair challenged. So I guess my question is for Ms. Lucero there, wouldn't this already be covered under any kind of discrimination for human rights? Is there something, is something I'm missing here, or is this kind of discrimination not covered under any kind of human rights laws that we have?
Commissioner.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Russell, thank you so much for that question. You know, our department has accepted these types of charges in the past. However, across the board, we agree with, you know, what Representative Agbaje said. It's really important to explicitly name this protection in our statute. It continues to be a problem. And as all of these testifiers have stated today, it's something that with that explicit naming in the statute could really go a long way to support students, kids, and people, just to show that this is a priority and this is important across the board. So I would encourage for this to pass.
Follow-up, Representative Grossel.
So what you just told me was that you've already taken on these type of cases, so this type of issue is already covered under current law.
Commissioner.
Representative Beckerfin, I think clarity and being explicit is very helpful, and we should listen to the stories of the testifiers today.
Chair Beckerfin, all right. Representative Agbaje.
I just wanted to add to that answer. Additionally, what happens in the court system sometimes is some judges look for very explicit language in the law about what's covered and what's not. And so by having this language in Minnesota law, we won't run into issues that have been seen in other states, like California saw before they passed it, where their law would not extend to covering hair discrimination because it was not explicitly stated in their human rights law. So that's what we want to do here. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Novotny.
Quick question. I don't know if it's for the author or for the commissioner, Lucero. It's more, what about uniform hair policies or for safety reasons? Would there be an exemption for workplace safety in something like this? I'll wait for a response.
Representative Agbaji.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Novotny, yes, this would allow for exceptions for safety as it already does in the law. So there wouldn't be no issues for that. Any business that had specific safety reasons for people keeping their hair covered or whatever the case may be, if they already have that exemption from the law, then this would not hamper that in any way.
Any follow-up, Representative Novotny?
Thank you, Chair. That'll be it.
All right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to thank Representative Agbaje for bringing this forward and thank all of the testifiers today. I know it's not easy to get in front of a group of people and talk about something as personal and as fraught as black hair, because really it is a political statement every single time that you wear your natural hair. And I just want to commend you for being really like brave and pushing this forward, because it's huge and it matters. It really does. This isn't an issue of, you know, whether or not somebody has taken the time to groom themselves. I think a lot of people underestimate how much time and energy it takes to groom natural hair. A perfectly coiffed afro takes a lot of time and energy. And so for anybody to look at that and say, well, that's not professional, that is 100% incorrect. And twists and locks all take an immense amount of upkeep. I know, I have done all of them. And so I just want to really share my support, my strong support for the Crown Act. And I hope that the rest of the folks in this committee will share my enthusiasm for it. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. We'll go to Representative Frazier and then we'll move on to the vote. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of just a statement. Representative Agbaje, thank you for bringing this bill. You know, I want to thank you on behalf of my three daughters, because I want to be in a state where absolutely the law recognizes that no one can treat them differently because of the way that they wear their hair and the way that they can express themselves through their hairstyles. I'm like Rep. Grosso. I am also lacking in the hair area, and I wish I could be more expressive with my hair. And if that was the case, I'd want to make sure that the law would protect me in doing so. So thank you very much for bringing this bill.
All right. Real quick, Representative Mortensen, and then we need to get moving. Representative Mortensen.
Madam Chair. I doubt anybody on this committee would support any sort of discrimination, whether it's on hair, skin color, whatever. But I do take issue with this language, because as it's been mentioned, this is going to become law. And tying and defining race based off of someone's hair appearance or style seems very shallow to me. And it makes me wonder, if I grew my hair out and I braided it, did I change my race suddenly? Because that's what this language would indicate. So I can't support this bill, because it defines race in a very strange and, I think, shallow way. So I'm kind of shocked. I'm the only one saying this, but I think race is much more meaningful than the appearance of somebody's hair.
I will I will direct other members, if you want to look at the actual language of the bill, it just says that race is inclusive of traits associated with race, including but not limited to hair texture and hairstyles, such as braids, locks, and twists. Representative Liebling, real quick, and then we got to get moving.
Yeah,
and just, Representative Egbadjay, we'll let you close.
Madam Chair, thank you so much. And I just have to respond to that because, you know what, as white people, sometimes we don't realize what we're reacting to. And here's the problem. You know, we look at, in sometimes in work situations and so on, we hear that people are getting pushback on their hair when it's really people perhaps unconsciously pushing back about their race. So that's the problem, Representative Mortensen and other white people here who may, we may not be aware of our own biases, but we need to listen to the voices of people who are on the receiving end and are telling us that they are receiving racial bias often through the medium of reacting to their hairstyles. So I think this is a great bill and I think we ought to pass it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Egbadjay, any closing comments before we move to the vote?
Yes, thank you so much, Chair Becker-Finn, and thank you to the committee for taking this time to hear us. I really do hope you take into your hearts just the fact that all we're trying to do is clarify our laws and making sure that people know that the way that they show up, the way that they present themselves, the way that who they, their whole selves is accepted in our society in Minnesota. And that's what we're trying to do today. And I look forward to your support for this bill. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. And thank you again to our testifiers. This was really great testimony. And I was really glad that we could move this during the first week of session because it is really important. With that, Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 1315 be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier. Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Farr, was that an aye? Representative Farr? Representative Farr?
Aye.
Perfect. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
And Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Right. So that is 15 ayes and 2 nays.
With that, the motion prevails and House File 1315 is on its way to the General Register. Again, thank you very much to our testifiers and to Representative Egbadjay for bringing this bill forward. With that, Commissioner Lucero, we'll have you back and we'll see how far we can get. Hopefully, if we do not have enough time for questions, I'm sure that the commissioner and Mr. Armakonki can come back to answer questions, but I would like to get through their presentation this morning. So Commissioner and Mr. Armakonki, if you wanna go forward with your presentation, that would be great.
Great. And are you able to see the PowerPoint slides there?
Yep, we're good to go.
Okay, so good morning again, everyone. My name is Rebecca Lucero. And as I said before, I am the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Eric Armakonki is here as well. While we are gonna give a brief presentation today, both of us are available offline to answer any questions and to talk about our agency's work. So the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, you know, we are Minnesota's civil rights agency. We work off of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and that has been in place for nearly 55 years. The agency is made up of about 45 full-time, hardworking, dedicated staff. This chart actually lays out what is covered under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And overall, employment is where we see the largest area of charges of discrimination that come in. When it comes to protected classes, now depending on the month, disability, sex, and that includes sexual harassment and race discrimination are pretty consistently the areas where we see Minnesotans reporting the most number of charges of discrimination. I think the best way to talk about our work since we were last together is actually to go through some of our recent cases. So, sorry, this is a lot of clicking here. So, first off, when it comes to a case here of Kathleen, this is a case that we announced the second half of last year. Kathleen filed a charge of discrimination with our office because she believed she had been terminated because of age discrimination. One of our investigators did a neutral fact-finding investigation and found that she had, in fact, been discharged because of her age. The owner said she was just too old to work with, couldn't work with her. And so once we found discrimination in that case, we worked with the employer to make changes to prevent discrimination from happening again, looking at policies and training moving forward. So this could not happen to Kathleen or anyone else moving forward with that employer. Last year, we also announced 6 sexual harassment cases across Minnesota in schools and in workplaces for young workers and adults. Demonstrating, of course, that sexual harassment is pervasive and persistent. I have a couple that I'm going to highlight here. First, McDonald's and Brewing Rock. And the story is the same in all of them. You'll see the same problems with policies and enforcement. When it comes to policies, the company's policies were ineffective. You'll see that others in positions of power were aware and failed to act. Here, this is a story of a 14-year-old whose 24-year-old manager repeatedly sexually assaulted her. When I talk about ineffective policies, you'll see the phone number that was listed in their sexual harassment policy guide. I mean, it was literally the letter X repeated, obviously not a phone number. So that is not effective policy. And again, there were others in positions of power who knew what was going on and didn't do anything to stop it. Same problems that you'll see in the Brewing Rock case. This case, again, an employee was sexually harassed multiple times by 3 of their coworkers. People in positions of power knew about it. The manager in this case told one of them not to worry about anything when they investigated it, didn't do anything about it. And the policies were ineffective. Again, we're looking at what are the policies, what are the training, and how are they being enforced to prevent this from happening ever again? So what are the structural changes in place? We also worked on this case that I'm going to just put up quickly, but I really wanna highlight our mediation work. Our mediation work was something that we brought up quite a bit at the beginning of last legislative session. We have been working really hard to grow our mediation work. I'm really proud of how that has grown. And the reason why our mediation work is important is because it's Minnesotans who are working together to find solutions that work for both parties. So at the end of the day, if you can find healing solutions where parties are coming together, that's really where the ideal work is. And so we work hard to see we really work hard to move as many folks into the mediation process as possible if it makes sense to do so. And we're seeing a lot of really good success there. So this is an example of a movie theater where through mediation, a woman and the movie theater owner were able to implement cost-effective changes that created a real positive solution for both of them moving forward. So these are just examples of a few of the cases that came out since session ended, quite late last summer. And I think that does a good job sharing the work of our agency. I know we'll talk moving forward about what might be helpful for our agency as we're talking about budget, but I'll just stop there and stand for any questions.
All right, it looks like Representative Johnson has a question.
Mr. Saro, thank you for being here today. I understand the importance of what your department does. And I actually have a situation going on that covers from my district all the way up almost to the Canadian border going on right now. Just occurred last week. We have an employer who did a mandate. About a third of their employees had religious exemptions that were honored, except that they have since now all been terminated this last week because of that religious exemption, not saying that they cannot provide any access for them to do their work. I'm just wondering if something like this would be something your department would handle, because it not only affects those employees, because it's a transit, they're not following the federal guidelines that they have to do the job and provide the services. Many people in my district and from all the way up almost to the Canadian border, the seniors and those with disabilities who use that service can no longer get to their employment. I had people waiting 2 hours for the bus that was never going to come. Our Walmart employees actually had to bring a number of people home that night when they stopped the service. So it's an issue that's really important in my district. It's important all through northeastern Minnesota because, like they say, they terminated, what I'm hearing, one-third of their employees and have disrupted service to not only my community, but a good part of Minnesota.
Response, Commissioner Lucero.
Yeah. Chair Beckerfin, Representative, thank you so much for sharing this with me. You know, what I would recommend is anyone who feels like they've been discriminated against, that they should contact our office and speak with an investigator. Every situation is such a case-by-case basis. And so anyone who thinks they've been discriminated, please do contact our office and talk to an investigator to see what might be the best path moving forward.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Saro, thank you for that. I will be contacting the number in my district that have brought this issue forward, and we'll be having more than likely a number of them contacting your office. Thank you.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just quickly, I just want to push back a little bit on some of the implications in Representative Johnson's statement, because, you know, yeah, there are workforce shortages all over the place, as we know. And we had a hearing yesterday in health and heard a lot about long COVID and the number of people who have been, who are affected by the pandemic, who are not able to be in the workforce because of COVID. So the idea that somehow mandates, vaccine mandates are the cause of these problems, the evidence is that if it's any part of it, it's a very, very small part. So I just wanted to make sure that that was clear. I know it's not the topic of this committee, but thank you for letting me say that, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Liebling. And we'll try to stay on topic. And I know that Commissioner Lucero and the Human Rights Department will be back when we have a bill and a budget request, and really appreciate their testimony and sharing the quick update with us today. One thing I do want to say before we wrap today is that for members too, whenever you have testifiers, you know, you're bringing bills forward and you have testifiers, I really do think it's important that we do our best to pronounce people's names correctly and that we take the time and the care to make sure that we do that. It really is a signifier of respect, and I think it's really important, which is why I always try to take the time to do my best to do that. And so I know that I direct my staff to ask folks, you know, if you could give me a pronunciation key as well as preferred pronouns. You know, we really want to conduct ourselves in the most respectful way in this committee. And so if you can, when our staff asks for that information, if you can share it, it would be greatly appreciated. With that, thank you, members, for a good discussion on the courts today, and I'm really glad that we could get the Crown Act moved in the first week. So with that, thank you, members. We are adjourned.